Accession number 30639, Mr. Alan Davis, Real 15. Now, you were saying about the normal flying, just routine flights? Yes. No particular point, I would imagine.
No, except that the chap who authorised, the flight commander at the time, would authorise you to do a cross-country from wherever you were to a specific turnaround point, just as an exercise. So you did cross-countries, you did a certain amount of formation flying in pairs, but it wasn't until much later on that we did big proper formation flying, and as much as three or more aeroplanes, because it's not the sort of thing that you did in a fighter reconnaissance squadron, but we did it as an exercise. So we were at Campo Formido for a while, during which time Gordon Henderson got sent home for his demob, so he and his wife departed with a very noteworthy party before he left.
What do you remember of it?
Well, I don't know how I shall tell you this, really, but there was an officer's leave hotel in Udine, to which we used to go to whenever we could afford.
And is that the one run by Kurt Dowsley?
No, it wasn't. No, it was a different one. This was in Udine. He didn't assume that sort of job until he went up into the mountains. I know this particular one, where we used to go quite often, when we could afford it, and Gordon Henderson had his leaving party in this particular hotel, or leave hotel. And where the alcohol was reasonably priced, and the food was certainly very reasonably priced, and the bedrooms were quite, you know, if you lived in a tent for rest of the time, living in that hotel in a proper bed was just gorgeous. But I remember his farewell party, and he got himself just a bit inebriated, let's say. And I remember him, the waiter came and served a whole lot of drinks to the table, and I remember Gordon Henderson grabbing the tray, which was a circular metal tray, and was going to spin it like a discus towards the table being occupied by some very senior officers. What had Gordon got to lose? He was on his way home. And the next day, he would be gone long before any action could be taken. And so, in his happy state, he flung this tray towards the senior officer's table. But fortunately, aerodynamically, it skimmed level for 20 yards, 20 feet perhaps. And then it gently zoomed upwards and lodged without, as I remember, doing any harm at all. It lodged in the chandelier. And it didn't break anything. And only the few of us who saw it and had tried to restrain Gordon Henderson from doing it and failed observed what had happened. And certainly the senior officers underneath the chandelier didn't know what had happened. So mercifully, it saved an awful lot of trouble by it being ended that way. But however, our Gordon was obviously a bit peeved that this particular action hadn't caused the mayhem he hoped it would. So later on, and when he was even more full of grog of some sort, he went upstairs for the obvious reason, and discovered that all these senior officers, who by then all had their wives out with them, had gone to bed, as they should have done, and left their shoes outside the door, as was the custom in those days. And they would be taken away and polished and brought back. And so he managed to swap all the shoes around. And the shoes that he finished up with at the end of the corridor, he decided that there was too much bother to go back and put outside somebody else's door. So he went into a bathroom and put them in the bath and put the plug in the bath and turned the taps on. And there they were all swimming around quite contentedly for presumably, I won't say whether the rest of the night, because we never bothered to find out how long they were there. Anyway, that's the sort of thing he did, and he certainly made up for lost time, so to speak, on his last 12 or 24 hours before he went home. Well, now that's the sort of thing that happened, but I also tell you one other thing, if we aren't extending the time.
No, you're fine.
Too far. When we were at Campo Formido, now let me start further back. Perhaps 2 years before that, before I went overseas at all, I had, with my father, had spotted a advert in the paper asking for people to apply to join the colonial service as a district officer. And they would accept applications from serving officers, and it would involve an interview or a series of interviews, and on the basis of the interviews and on the particular officer's background, then they would do their choosing from that. So my brother-in-law was in the colonial service, serving in West Africa, and we had therefore learned a great deal about the colonial service and what it did or set out to do. My brother-in-law was in the customs and excise branch as an administrator. So they wanted that they were recruiting for people to fill the vacant places in colonial service by interview. And my father and I worked out that if I made application, and I was genuinely interested in doing this sort of job, we worked out that if they were going to do it by interview, they would inevitably have to call you to an interview in London. They might be preliminary interviews at wherever one might finish up in Bombay or Singapore or any of these places where there was a colonial service. So there would be preliminary interviews there, but there would have to be an interview back in London at some stage. And sure enough, by the time we were at Campo Formido, I had the preliminary interviews and not been told whether I'd been selected or not selected. But if they kept on interviewing you, presumably you were still in the running. And quite out of the blue, when we were at Campo Formido, and Gordon Henderson was still then the CO, a signal came through requesting that Flying Officer Davis report to the colonial office in London by such and such a date, let's say some 7 to 10 days hence. So Gordon Henderson had never received a signal like this before, ever. And he called me in and said, "What the hell is this? Why have you been called back to London for an interview when the rest of us have all been out here months and months and months without getting a chance of going back to UK for any reason at all? What's it all about?" So I explained to him how it occurred, not telling him that my father and I had worked it out that this might happen, but I did say that I was half expecting to be called for an interview, but I didn't know it was going to be back in London. So the adjutant then had to organise everything for me to have a pass and a travel warrant and all the necessary papers to go by whatever transport was available from Udine or Campo Formido, excuse me, back to London. So that meant a truck ride from Campo Formido to summer in Austria, where the train started from, and then onto a train from somewhere in Austria. I've just forgotten the name of the place for the moment, it doesn't really matter. Right across Austria, through Germany, through France, and it took about 3 days. It was called Midlock, Middle East something, lines of communication, it stood for Medlock. Everybody knew of it because everybody who was going on leave had to go by the same route. And it was a tedious and uncomfortable. They were hard seats in the railway coaches, and there was no sleeping accommodation. They did stop over at least once, if not twice, in the most awful transit camps, where we got fed and got food, I suppose, and eventually got to the north coast of France, and then on the troop ship again across to England and to Dover, and then by train from Dover to London to report to and I got there just in time, just at the right day, and in time to get to the report for interview by 11 o'clock in the morning or something like that. So I went straight there, and then had the interview, which was a bloody disaster as far as I was concerned, because I was mentally quite unprepared for the sort of questions they asked, which I won't bother you with. But the end product was that I didn't get selected. I got a letter saying that the Secretary of State, Mr. Creech Jones, had decided not to accept my application, which was quite fair and quite blunt. But after that, I had to go back to Ad Astra House, the Air Force headquarters in London, to get return papers for go get back to Italy. So I was ushered into the office of a most delightful old lady who was doing the administration there. And I said I wanted a pass and railway warrants and so on to get back to Campo Formido or near Udine in northern Italy. And she just set about, because these were forms which I had to fill in and put the necessary dates and so on. And I said to her, well, now, you're dating this travel warrant. Is there anything to stop you dating it in 2 or 3 days' time so that I can go home and see my parents? I haven't seen my parents for years and years, says I, having seen them only for 6 months before. But I didn't explain quite clearly the dates, but I did say that I hadn't seen them for a long time. And would it be possible for her, instead of using today's date, just to date the travel warrant for, let's say, 3 days hence, which would give me time to go home and see my parents, which is exactly what my father and I had thought might happen. And so the dear old thing took pity on me and dated these in advance. And not only that, I think she gave me a travel warrant to go from London down to Exeter and back as well, so I didn't even have to pay for that. Anyway, she was both generous and sensible and understanding, and I didn't have to tell too many untruths to get it. But I made a convenience out of going back home for this interview, even though it had been extremely uncomfortable actually travelling. Okay, so I went home and had say 48 hours at home, which was lovely. My parents were, as always, very pleased to see me, and I was very pleased to see them. And back then to do the reverse journey, which I won't bore you with, exactly the same procedure, trains and troops, ferries go across the channel and so on, and then right back to Udine. And when I got to Udine, it was fairly late in the afternoon, and there would have been time, I must admit, to ring up the 2-5 squadron and get transport to join them at the Campo Formido, which is what, 4 or 5 miles outside Udine, I suppose. And so I thought, no, what the hell, they won't know what day I have arrived back here. I will stay at this lovely Leave Hotel, Albergo something or other, can't remember its name. I will have one more night of luxury before I go back to my tent. So I stayed the night there, had dinner there, and rang up next morning for transport to get back. So about 10 o'clock in the morning, I got back to the airfield, and as is proper, duly reported to the admin caravan, in which Gordon Henderson was sitting. And he said, "Oh," when I got through the door, "Oh, you're back then. Where have you been all this time? You've been 10 days or whatever it was. You've been away 10 days just for one interview." And I said, "Oh, yes, well, I had a lot of difficulty with transport and so on, and this was the soonest I could get back here." "Oh, all right." Just then, though, the telephone rang in his caravan. And so he picked up the phone, said who he was, and he said, this conversation went something like this. "Yes, sir? Yes, sir, I understand. I have the very person here. Yes, he's Flying Officer Davis, Flying Officer A.G. Davis." And so he said, "Yes, he'll report to you, or he'll report at such and such an office tomorrow morning." "Very good. Thank you very much, sir. Goodbye." And hung up. And he turned to me and said, "You've just been nominated as a defending officer for somebody at his court-martial. If you could stay away from the squadron for 10 days, thinking of going to join the colonial service, this will be good training for you." So that's how I was selected, in inverted commas, selected to defend this poor chap at his court-martial.
Now tell me about that, well, as much as you can.
All right, well, quickly then. I had to go and interview this lad who'd been caught. He was an MT driver, and his vehicle had been loaded up with high octane fuel in 50-gallon, whatever they were, 50-gallon drums. These quite, 3 foot tall containers for aviation fuel, and he'd obviously flogged 2 or 3 of them, more perhaps, and because when he drove back into the depot or MT yard, a warrant officer happened to be at the guard room past which he had to drive, and there was a big bump in the surface of the road, which his vehicle had to go through, which he drove over at some speed, obviously, because these 50-gallon drums of aviation fuel, which should have been full of fuel, bounced about in the back of this vehicle. So the warrant officer knew perfectly well that he was bringing back empty drums where he should have been bringing back, or should have been in transit with full drums. So he got caught for not having the fuel on board his vehicle. And so he's caught absolutely hook, line and sinker.
Anything you could do for him,
Bob? Well, they even found the money that he'd got in his kit. Less about a couple of hundred lira when he'd bought himself something with the spare cash. But they found the 200 or 300 or 400 or whatever it was, lira, in his kit bag. So he was well and truly guilty. So I tried in his court-martial to plead that he was an innocent who had been led astray and didn't know that this wasn't the thing to do, so to speak, because that's what he would have heard from all his friends in the billet that he would have been in. So, and he was about 18 or 19 years old, quite a boyish looking airman. And, of course, I told him to get a haircut before the court-martial. And he'd had a prison haircut. And he was absolutely shorn up the back of his neck, right up to almost to the crown of his head, with a real sort of convict's haircut. And anybody couldn't have looked more guilty if he'd, more of a criminal than that he'd tried. But also, of course, had nicked some of the sort of spots on the back of his neck and head From the back, he looked absolutely terrible because he had these sore-looking traces on the back of his skull and neck, and this terribly short haircut. And he'd been in close arrest for, well, I don't know how many weeks, certainly several months anyway, by the time the court-martial came up. And so I went, had to just defend this chap and plead, I think it was called a plea of mitigation. And I remember some of the other chaps on the squadron, like Kurt Tausig and Phil Whitaker, and probably Pippler. Officers under instruction to watch my performance, which was a bit embarrassing, since I'd had never had any instruction at all on how to conduct myself, except a bit verbally. I mean, I was told, you know, whether you put your hats on or your hats off or whatever. And we seem to have got that right. Anyway, this chap, I think he only got, because they had recovered almost all the money, and because he'd been in close arrest for 2 or 3 months, he only got 56 days. His sentence was only 56 days, which was quite nominal, really, because he probably served most of that anyway, if not all of it. So it was a purely paperwork exercise to sentence him. Anyway, he didn't get off. I didn't get him off anything. And that was the price I had to pay for skiving off to UK. But it looked very good on my documents thereafter. I didn't explain on my documents how I got selected. I'm really told that I had been selected to defend a chap on his court-martial.
Now, anything else happened? Any other stories from Campo Formida?
Yes, well, I can go on and on with this. Because there was so little to do, we were able to get an allocation of horses, previously German army horses, for recreational purposes. And we had to get somebody who would nominally be responsible. And my friend Jeff Vaughan said, for crying out loud, don't get yourself caught for that. Because he said, if something goes wrong, you'll be in the most awful bother, and it'll involve you in having to appear before the Air Vice Marshal and all that sort of thing. And sure enough, one of the horses did die. But meanwhile, before he died, we had these half a dozen horses of varying sizes. And we used to saddle them up. We had one sergeant who was very keen that we should do this and volunteered to be mostly responsible for their excuse me, for their housing and their feeding and the welfare of them. And they were delightful creatures because we used to saddle them up, and having very little to do, all ranks were able to use them, but when we were able to do so, we used to, half a dozen of us used to go down to the kennels, to the stables rather, and harness them up and ride them over the airfield. Well, none of us had any riding lessons before, so it was an experimental sort of, can we manage to ride these horses at some speed and get away with it? And some of us took to it quite easily and naturally. And the great thing about driving these horses or riding these horses over the airfield was that there were quite a lot of bomb craters and ditches and so on the side of the single runway, and one could persuade these horses to jump over these little obstacles. They weren't particularly dangerous, they weren't particularly big jumps, but at least the horse left the ground. And none of us, those of us who'd never ridden a horse before, some of us got the most terrific fun out of doing this and hanging on like grim death, and became fairly proficient, I suppose. Except one of the army officers who, I told you that we had a major and two captains. One of the captains used to come with us, and he wasn't quite so quick at picking up the technique, and perhaps he was a bit older and heavier than the rest of us. Certainly would have been a few years older. Of course, he fell off and we didn't realise he'd fallen off until his horse caught up with us with no rider on it. So we had to go back and collect him. And he was so cross, A, that he'd fallen off, and B, that we'd spent so long turning round and going to fetch him. But he didn't apparently hurt himself in any way, which was lucky. But to continue this, we rode these horses, you know, quite a few times, and so did the airmen and so on. But I found I had to have a whole wad of about 12 inches by 12 inches of 1 inch thick cotton wool stuffed down my trousers, because I rode so badly. I found I made myself very sore. However, this cotton wool did the trick. But one of these horses did die. It died of, I suppose, colic or something, swelled up, and wasn't able to get rid of the gases which formed in his stomach. So poor thing died. And there he was on the, because we commandeered these stables in the village. Of course, the Italians were very keen to loan out their buildings for this purpose, because they got handsomely rewarded for it. The Air Force paid them rent for it, whereas they would have got, you know, nothing but a few hundred lira coming into the village. But we were therefore very popular. But so one of the horses died, and we had to frantic telephone calls of what do we do. And of course, by the time we got back to the horse, the villagers had carved some very hefty chunks of meat out of the flank of this horse. And so we thought, there is absolutely no point in us obeying the instructions from headquarters to see to this horse's burial. We will tell the villagers that it has to be buried, and then promise not to come back and see where they buried it. So the Italian villagers got the message very quickly. So he left the horse where it was, and it was satisfactorily disposed of, and nobody ever saw any hide nor hair of it again. But the villagers stored away enough meat to last them for several months from it. So that was quite a happy ending.
How did you get on with the Italians?
Well, really very well, because the war had been over some time, and they tolerated us, and a lot of them got employed by us as washer girls and waiters and generally cleaner uppers. So quite a lot of them made some money out of it, and certainly if they had any labouring, any ditches to be dug or drainage ditches in particular, they did it, and we paid them for it. So we were popular in that respect. But one day we woke up and found that our generator, which supplied electricity to all the tents and all the living and mess quarters, the whole generator had been pinched. And it just disappeared. And it was a German generator, which we had inherited or commandeered or something, purchased. No, I don't know if we purchased it. We just commandeered it, I expect, from some German unit, because it wasn't on charge to us. It was just one we'd acquired, and it was very efficient. It had just disappeared. So Gordon Henderson, in his wisdom, said, right, we will search the village. We were camped quite nearby. We will search the village until we find it. So without any warning, he got some of the airmen stationed at each end of the road that ran through the village, and I don't think we had any rifles, because, well, we may have done, and we had some sort of other rifles, or, well, because we must have had, because all the airmen on guard duty had rifles. So he made sure that all these airmen at both ends of the road and scattered round about the village had rifles, and they were very visible. That's the point. So he then took a party from house to house searching for RAF gear.